the very, very competitive practices that we would have at the Hellenic College, which Dennis Johnson and Danny Ainge and Larry and Kevin and Chief were the starting five, but with Jerry C. Sting and Scott Wedman and David Thurdkill and Bill Walton, we had a real competitive second team. And I can just remember being a rookie on that team and going home thinking, man, I get to play great basketball every day against great players and get paid. This is just the best thing in the world.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
We're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass, yes. Christian, can you catch the ball, yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time, and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 83. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm excited to welcome Michigan's first Mr. Basketball, Michigan State University star, NBA champion, and now global coach, Sam Vincent, to the show. We cover Sam's fantastic on-court career, and as of this recording, he's more than 20 years of coaching and developing the game of basketball globally. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, are at inallairness.com/83. Now, onto the show. My guest today was Michigan's first Mr. Basketball. He starred as a high schooler, captured a state championship, and was a four-year standout at Michigan State University. He played seven NBA seasons, and since retiring from the league, he's coached and promoted the sport of basketball extensively. Sam Vincent, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Adam. Pleasure to be here and pleasure to be on the show.
I'm really excited to chat with you today, and I want to quickly thank a great friend of the show, Terrence Stansbury. He was a guest on episode 58 of the podcast, and he initially gave me the idea and helped us to connect today, so I appreciate that, so thanks to Terrence.
Terrence is a wonderful guy, so hopefully he's listening to the show, and I'll extend my regards to Terrence as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, he's a great guy. He's very generous when we chatted, and he helped get in touch with yourself early on. Now, I'd always actually thought that your first name was Sam. However, I've since learnt that your given name is James. And from what I've read, your nickname is courtesy of your older brothers. Now, how did Sam come to be?
Well, my given name is James. And all throughout elementary and most of my early years, I was James. And somewhere along the way, and you know, Adam, there's a few different stories. So
I've read one of them. Yep.
My older brothers have stories. My mom has stories. You know, I don't know if I've ever gotten any of them to really tell me the truth. But I do know that the genesis of Sam did come from my oldest brother, Johnny, who was, I believe, one of the story goes, watching a program on television when we were kids. And there was a character named Sammy. There was some personality similarities, and the older brother decided, hey, I'm just going to start calling you Sammy from now on. And so Sammy just kind of stuck for a while. And then from Sammy, it became Sam. And I never was able to get rid of it. So I've had it for some time and it's lived on and it's become a part of my name.
Yeah, I never knew until I started looking into the background behind your career. And I was surprised to learn that wasn't your actual given name. Most listeners to this show would know that one of your older brothers, I think you're one of five brothers, your older brother Jay was a key member of the 1979 NCAA champion Michigan State Spartans. And of course, he was college teammates with Magic Johnson. And then Jay would go on to play 9 years in the NBA. At what age did you become interested in basketball, Sam?
I became interested in basketball around, I would say, 7 or 8 years old. A big part of that influence was watching Jay, who was 4 years older. He was playing middle school basketball at that time. And, Irvin Johnson, who later became Magic, was his crosstown rival. So I would go and watch those guys play against each other, and really kind of sparked an interest in getting involved with playing from watching them too.
Wow. Okay. So when you saw those guys go at it, even before they became college teammates, you could probably tell that both were going to be great players because Jay went on to have a great career in the NBA. All rookie first selection, I think, in 1982 and averaged more than 20 points and 7 boards with the Mavericks in that first season. Could you tell straight away that these guys were going to be outstanding at the next level?
You know, I really at that time, watching both Jay and Irvin, never really thought about whether or not they would play professional basketball. It was really just purely the enjoyment of watching those two guys who were both, you know, 6'8", you know, just real tall players at young ages and really playing completely different styles of basketball on the court. It was entertaining. And the thought of where they potentially could go at that time wasn't something I thought about. It was just really great basketball games, big crowds, and really fun to see the competition.
In one article I read about you, it said that your favorite sport, at least at that stage, was tennis. How good of a player were you on the tennis courts?
I was never a great tennis player. I was just always an admirer of the sport. You know, I appreciated the agility and the swings and the speed. And really was a fan during that time of Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi and Bjorn Borg. And I mean, I just, you know, I enjoyed and connected with the game.
You played for the Eastern Quakers in high school in Lansing, Michigan. You were dubbed Sir Slam, which was a nickname I actually wasn't familiar with before I started researching. And based on the photos I've uncovered since researching about your career, that doesn't surprise me. There's some great photos of you getting up for some big dunks. Just before we discuss your team's amazing run in 1980. Can you please just set the scene a little bit about your early high school career at Eastern?
Yeah, well, I had, prior to playing at Lansing Eastern, played at Walter French Middle School throughout Jay's Eastern high school career, again against Magic at Everett High School. I would go to all of those games and, you know, I really enjoyed watching that Lansing Eastern team along with all the players. Just kind of gradually became a bigger, bigger fan of the sport of Lansing Eastern. And so coming into my 10th grade year, I had already had a pretty good education of what high school basketball was all about, having followed Jay throughout the local high school games and pretty much having followed Irvin even through the quarterfinals and the semifinals of the state competition. So coming in the Eastern, I was pretty well prepared as a sophomore to jump right in and play.
In terms of being around Irvin at such a formative age and part of his career, when he's playing alongside and also, against your brother, how much sort of interaction did you have with him? And was he always such an outgoing and friendly guy as he so often appeared to be from the moment he pretty much hit the college stage?
Yeah. Irvin was always very passionate. It's one of the things that I remember about him from the middle school days as a basketball player. He was a skinny guy, very tall, obviously didn't have the skills that he later developed, but he always had the big smile.
Mm.
That was one of the things that really kind of drew me into basketball was the energy and excitement that both Jay and Magic had during those middle school and high school years for the sport. It was clear to see that they just loved playing the game and competing and were really excited about improving and getting better.
And the state of Michigan has some fantastic fans as well, and that's evident throughout the many decades, of course, too. As I alluded to a moment ago, as a junior, your Quakers won the Class A state championship, and in the opening round district game, if I've got my stats correct, versus Everett, who I think is Magic's former high school team. You were down by 8 points with only a couple of minutes left in regulation and then reeled off 6 straight points to force overtime and also scored the first 5 points in overtime and ended up with about 31 points in a very stirring 6-point win. What are your memories of that particular game? Because that was almost the stumbling block to what would be that 1980 state championship.
Well, you know, I remember that being just an incredible matchup. There was a real good basketball player named Craig Fields that played on that team. And Craig Fields and I were teammates a few years earlier on the Walter French Middle School team. So We knew each other real well. We were very competitive, very good friends. But I lived in a different area and went on to play at Lansing Eastern, and Craig went on to play at Lansing Everett. And I remember, very well before that game, Craig saying to me and to some of the fans that, you know, he knew my strengths. This was going to be the game that they won, and this was going to be the team that took us down. And for pretty much 3.5 quarters, everything Craig said had pretty much came to fruition. But somewhere there in the end of that game, I don't know, something clicked over, and the will to just fight a little bit harder, you know, really popped in, and I was able to get a little more late game confidence and make a couple shots. And then all of a sudden at the beginning of the overtime, that confidence was still riding high. And it was a real important, game to give not only me, but our whole team the confidence that we could go on and win a state championship.
And that's exactly what you guys did, in the semifinal of the state championship. You dropped 31 points and then went on to defeat, Highland Park at Chrysler Arena, and then won the championship game 64-53. So I read that your Quakers finished the season 26-1. And had 21 straight victories. In that final game, you had 16 points on just 9 shots, which is excellent. Just in terms of that final game, also actually doubled as the first championship for Eastern since 1934, which I found to be an incredible little stat there. What are your recollections of that semi-final, and then also when you clinched that state championship?
Well, it was an incredible run. You know, everybody had a little bit of a target on our back. The year before, we had got to the quarterfinals, I believe, and really had a great season, but lost somewhere in the run up to the state championship. And so coming back, you know, everybody wanted to beat us. They wanted to not, you know, give us a chance to move on. So every single game was important. I think our coach, Paul Cook, really did an excellent job that year of keeping the guys focused and really emphasizing team basketball, even though I was the guy that, you know, could score 30 points or could have a big night. We had some other real good players on that team, and on any given night, somebody else would step up and score 20 or 25. And I thought we did a good job of sharing the ball, and that was a real big key to our success that season.
Do you remember how the region celebrated the state championship win and the following days, and how that felt to be part of a state championship winning team?
Yeah, I remember it being an incredible feeling. I remember that semifinal game very well at Jennison Fieldhouse, where I had a big game and really had a lot of nervous energy about getting out of the semifinal and then having a chance to get to Chrysler Arena and play in the finals. When we actually won that game, it was really a well-balanced team approach. There was a couple other guys in double digits, and you know, everybody got a chance to play and participate, and it was a great moment. It was something that I think not only the teammates and the coaching staff really enjoyed, but my family was there, and Jay having had his success, and now at Michigan State, it was just, it was a very special time.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. Now, I'd just like to briefly touch on a couple of games from your senior high school season. The first of which was around Christmas time in 1980. You dropped 61 points on 28 of 38 from the field, including 5 dunks against a team called Waverley. And then that simultaneously eclipsed a city scoring record that was held by Irvin Johnson. I think he had 54 points. So reflecting on that particular game, what sort of springs to mind from that performance, Sam?
It was a game where I think players often refer to just being in some sort of zone.
Mm.
I was not aware really at any point during the game how many points I had. It was definitely not a game that I went into thinking about, you know, anything other than winning. But at some point late in the game, I think after I was past 54, somebody, you know, alerted me to how many points I had. And at that point, you know, I scored a few more times, but I think the one thing that's never really mentioned is I didn't play in the fourth quarter of that game. So
wow.
Right after getting the record, Coach Cook took me out. You know, it was really not about chasing Magic's record. It was just one of those games where we were fast breaking. We were running. I was making shots and everything was just, the stars were all aligned perfect.
Yeah, that's an incredible performance. And just the second game I'd like to briefly discuss, was your final high school game. Probably a bit of a sore point, I guess, when you look at it. It was a triple overtime, 1 point loss, 82-81. Just days prior, from what I understand, you were named the state's first Mr. Basketball. So do you mind just contrasting the highs of winning that first award and then also the lows of not being able to make it back to that state championship game to try and defend that title, Sam?
Very disappointing. It was a very disappointing loss. I thought our team obviously really fought hard. We played against a very competitive team out of Detroit who just would not, they just wouldn't give in. And having won the Mr. Basketball award slightly before that and thinking I'd have a chance to win a back-to-back at that time, state championship was something that I was really excited about. So losing that game by a point was something that has always kind of, you know, one of those things that you wish you could go back and have one less turnover or make one more free throw or do something a little bit different. But it really capped off a high school career that I'll always remember as a very special time in my life, and really enjoyed the opportunity to play basketball during that period.
Yeah, well, it was an outstanding high school career for sure. You were named a high school All-American and in April of 1981 took part in the McDonald's All-American game at Wichita. Your West squad lost the game 96-95 to a Michael Jordan-led East team. Was this the first time that you had played against Jordan, and how was the experience of taking part in a game with so many great players from across the country?
That was my first time meeting Michael, and Michael and I from that game became good friends and never really realized that we would have an intertwined future the way we've had. It was great being there and having a chance to play with Patrick Ewing and Aubrey Sherrard and Enos Watley, so many guys that eventually went into NBA careers and had successful both collegiate, high school, and professional careers. And I remember well, prior to the beginning of that game, several people having a conversation about who would be the MVP of that game. And there were several guys mentioned. I think Greg Dreiling, you know, got a couple votes, and a kid named Anthony Jones from DC had a couple votes. And I don't remember Michael at that time getting any votes as someone who could possibly be MVP of that game.
Okay.
Michael came out, scored 30, and really just had an incredible McDonald's All-American game. And I think everybody left Wichita knowing that this guy was getting ready to have a fantastic basketball career.
Yeah, it's fairly interesting that your careers, as you were saying, and lives would intertwine so many years down the track, and we'll certainly get to that a bit later. Earlier that same year, you actually held a press conference to announce that you'd be signing with the Michigan State Spartans, and it was unique due to the fact that your brother Jay, who was a senior at the time with the Spartans, was there with you, and I found a great photo from the archives online of that said press conference. Do you mind just talking a little bit about your memories of that particular press conference, what you can recall, and how special was it to actually have an older brother there with you to help do that announcement?
I remember speaking to Jay quite a bit before making that decision, and I was a little bit torn between Michigan State and the University of Michigan.
Hmm.
Coach Bill Frieder had really spent quite a bit of time coming up and putting some extra pressure on in the recruiting battle. And I was kind of starting to change my mind and consider the Wolverines. And I remember a conversation with Jay and him expressing how much he enjoyed the student life at Michigan State and how great it was to be able to play at home in front of family and friends. And then he said, and if you decide to go to Michigan State, I'm going to come to your press conference. But if you go to University of Michigan, I'm not. So. So I decided, you know, I might want to have him there. It might be kind of fun to have his support. So, okay, fine. I'll go to Michigan State. But in the end, I was really excited that I did. And I had a chance to, you know, spend quite a bit of time around the Michigan State program, watching that 79 championship team and getting to know all the players and Coach Heathcote prior to joining the team. And it just really made that whole 8 years, 4 years before coming to Michigan State and then 4 years after, a very special time.
Yeah, it's a really unique scenario, and I'll include a photo from that press conference in the show notes to this episode. So our listener can have a look at that. And yeah, it's really a great photo with Jay atop your shoulder. As you said, I guess if you hadn't gone to Michigan State, he might not have even been in that photo. So that's quite amusing. At Michigan State, you played three seasons with a couple of future NBA players, Kevin Willis and Scott Skiles. What was it like to play with those guys, and how did the team begin to build itself back into becoming a Big Ten contender there, Sam?
Well, it was fantastic playing with both Kevin and Scott. Again, none of us at that time knew what kind of careers we eventually would have leaving Michigan State. So we were just enjoying the time. And when Scott came in my sophomore year, it was a welcomed addition to the team because he came with a lot of savvy and a lot of heart. And we became a backcourt, at Michigan State that really was a strong backcourt. Kevin Willis, who had joined us from the Jackson Community College, was a young up and coming center, who was still developing his game, but gave us a third player that we really felt was going to project us, into some real depth in the NCAAs. And I think we got some early rankings, that sophomore, maybe junior year. But we suffered a few injuries. We never really were able to live up to the expectations of what that team should have been able to accomplish.
I appreciate you opening up about this. It's fascinating to hear this sort of stuff from someone who was obviously right there involved in this as it was happening. As a senior, you were named the team captain along with a guy named Richard Mudd. How much notice were you given about that honor ahead of the senior season commencing?
I think going into that senior year, Richard Mudd and I were kind of the elder statesmen of that team. Kevin Willis had left. There were a couple other guys who prior to that year were candidates, but for some reason, really just were not interested in that type of role. So it was something that we gave each of our players an opportunity to chime in and nominate the guys that they wanted to represent them as team captains. So Richard and I were both, you know, really honored to be selected from our peers to be those team captains, and we took that responsibility serious. And I think we both did a pretty good job that season.
It was a great season for the team. You made it to the NCAA tournament, which we'll get to in just a moment. You actually started that same season on fire. You won 12 of the first 13 games. And at Purdue on January the 10th of 85, you had a massive game, had 39 points in a 9-point overtime win. Do you remember much about that particular game or just the hot streak to the start of that season?
Well, I remember us coming into that season really well prepared. We hadn't had the type of year before that we had hoped for with Kevin Willis as a senior. And we were all a little bit down, a little disappointed. And I think everybody put a little bit more energy into their off-season preparation. So we got back to campus and really put the hard work in, and we're really dedicated. And I think that showed in the beginning. Like you said, we got off to a great start. The team was playing well. And that specific game at Purdue, I remember having a very slow first half. And for some reason, just not playing well. I think I might have had a little bit of a bug. But I remember Coach Heathcote at halftime came in and gave me one of those typical head-banging Judd Heathcote moments. That became the inspiration in the second half to go out and play a whole lot better. So it's a game that I'll always remember. It's something that I'll always remember Coach Heathcote for, because I really felt as a coach, he was really special at understanding the variety of ways that you have to motivate players. And he was really crafty at understanding the personalities on our team. And I think that went for the 79 championship team as well. And just being able to tap into different guys' energies different ways. And I thought he was masterful in that specific game, because my second half performance was able to propel us to a real difficult win.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you scored at least 30 points in that second half. When I was looking at a recap of a great game you played for the Bulls in 1988, I don't want to jump the gun, but it said it was your best single half performance since this particular game in 1985. So you must have gone for about 30 plus. So a fantastic effort in a big time game. Now, later that same season, you had a 10-point win at Indiana, and that helped clinch the Spartans a berth in the NCAA tournament, and it was the first appearance since winning it all in 1979. Now, you had 31 points, made 11 of 11 free throws, had 6 rebounds and also 5 assists, so an outstanding game. And the Hoosiers coach, Bobby Knight, praised your performance afterwards. In the article, there was even a brief mention of how yourself and Scott Skiles were perhaps overlooked for the 1984 Olympic tryouts. And of course, Bob Knight was the head coach of Team USA. What did you make of that particular win over the Hoosiers? And did you think much about the fact that you didn't get a look in for those trials?
Well, I took the comment as a real compliment coming from Coach Knight, who, you know, prior to me playing in that game had spent time with Quinn Buckner, you know, Scott May, Isaiah Thomas. I mean, he had had a list of, you know, just incredible guards on his team. So I thought the compliment coming from Coach Knight was something that was much appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
As it relates to the 84 trials and not having a chance to at least get to the trials, you know, that was a disappointing knock. But I think Scott and I both kind of felt like there were a lot of politics that went into those decisions, and it wasn't always purely based on the performance of the players.
Mm.
And we both kind of felt like, you know, by not getting that opportunity, it wasn't something that we hadn't done. So I think the validation of his comments afterwards was something that both Scott and I appreciated.
Yeah, for sure. Now, in the tournament itself, the NCAA tournament, you had 32 points and 6 rebounds, and Scott Skiles added 15 points and he had 8 assists, but you just dropped the game 70-68 to Alabama Birmingham. Now, looking back on that game and just your college experience as a whole, what sort of stands out most from that time in your life there, Sam?
Just the opportunity to be connected to so many wonderful basketball experiences up to that point. It wasn't just the friendships and the camaraderie. It was also the competition. It was the relationships. So up to that point for me, I really had a chance to just reflect on how much the game had meant to me and how proud I was to be able to participate, play, compete on a high level and have had the success that I had.
You've had some great honors throughout your college career, and I'll just quickly reel off a few of these great achievements. You won the Big Ten scoring title as a senior, averaging almost 24 points a game. You were named all Big Ten first team as a junior and senior, and you were named most improved player in 85 for the Spartans team as well. Plus a slew of other things that I haven't even mentioned. Now you're currently seventh all time in career scoring for the Spartans, one spot behind another guy named Vincent, your brother Jay. Do you ever sort of reminisce about your spots in the all-time scoring there, or that's just something you don't concern yourself with too much?
Jay and I, from time to time, we will talk about the fact that as a brother combination, we were able to, through all of the great players that have come through Michigan State, remain in the top 10 in scoring. And as recent as a few days ago, we've talked about just some opportunities to collaborate and really share our story. Because of course he had a story from 77 to 81 that included a championship and playing with Magic.
Yeah.
And I had a run from 81 to 85 that included playing with Scott and with Kevin. And so we feel like there's just some incredible stories around Coach Heathcote and the players and the championships and the Big Ten scoring championships. And at some point, we will collaborate and come up with a way to share some of those experiences in a way that, that it's enjoyable for the fans of Michigan State.
Ah, oh, that's great. I really like the sound of that. It sounds exciting. Heading into the 1985 NBA draft, you were picked 20th overall by the Boston Celtics. That's the draft, of course, where Patrick Ewing went number one to the Knicks. Did you have any idea about teams that were interested in you, or what were you doing in preparation for that draft day, Sam?
Well, I had heard about a few teams that were interested, and I had heard a range of anywhere from 13 to 20 where I could go. And the interesting thing was, you know, in the draft, you never really know what's going to happen because it only takes one team to draft a player outside of what the speculations were. And then all of a sudden the whole draft goes in a different direction. So I was on pins and needles. I did not go to New York to attend the draft. I was at my apartment watching with family. And obviously being called number 20th to the Celtics was a day that, you know, I'll always remember, very special time. And, you know, the beginning of that next chapter of, you know, something that had to that point just been very, very special in my life, playing basketball.
Now, the whole first round, was that actually shown on TV? So you got to hear your name called on the TV broadcast?
Yeah, the whole first round was shown on TV from my apartment when they called my name. I was able to see the video of my Michigan State career that they played. And then shortly after that, I got a call from the Celtics and, you know, just all of the details surrounding what would happen next. So it was a pretty incredible and special time.
How did you find that transition from being a college star to fighting for playing time on a roster that featured some of the all-time greatest players and just collectively one of the best teams of all time in the NBA?
Well, it was an adjustment. It was a tough adjustment coming in, having been a player that from high school to college had been in a starting role and in a pretty important scoring role. So now all of a sudden I was going up to that next level where all of the players there had been well entrenched. They were all veterans and eventual, you know, Hall of Famers.
Mm.
So breaking into that situation was tough. That rookie year was just, you know, a little bit frustrating because I didn't get the playing time that I was hoping for.
I can only imagine how difficult that was. There's not a lot that hasn't really been said, I guess, about the 1986 Celtics. You won the NBA championship in your rookie year. They went 67-15, and you lost only once through the Eastern Conference Finals. Do you have a story or any recollection of something that particularly stands out from your time on or off the court with the Celtics there, Sam?
You know, there, Adam, there was a lot of incredible memories, just a lot of incredible games and the travel. And, you know, there's been so many things that had happened before then and so many things after.
Mm.
But one of the things that really sticks out and stands out, there's probably a couple things. Number one, the very, very competitive practices that we would have at the Hellenic College, which Dennis Johnson and Danny Ainge and Larry and Kevin and Chief were the starting five. But with Jerry C. Sting and Scott Wedman and David Thurdkill and Bill Walton, we had a real competitive second team. And I can just remember being a rookie on that team and going home thinking, man, I get to play great basketball every day against great players and get paid. This is just the best thing in the world. It was a fantastic time and it was a fantastic team. And the only other thing I really, really, just really as an incredible high point was the actual parade at the end of the season, where we were able to go downtown and on the fire truck and with all the players and all the screaming fans and, record another Celtics championship. That was just, two just really incredible memories.
That's fantastic to hear. I appreciate you, reminiscing about those two. In mid-October of 1987, the Celtics traded you along with Scott Wedman, to Seattle. You had played 129 games for Boston. How did you first learn of the news of that trade to Seattle and what was your sort of first reaction?
Well, I got the news from Coach Jones. Coach Jones came in and, we were actually at a game and he came to me prior to the beginning of the game. And I remember him saying that I wouldn't play that night, because the team had decided to make a trade. And that, he felt it was something that would be in the best interest for me, being that I was a young player and really, you know, wanting to play and be on the floor and just not getting those kind of opportunities in Boston. So it was a difficult period. I think, you know, there was two sides of feeling disappointed about leaving the situation I had got drafted to and the guys that I knew, but also a little bit of anticipation and excitement about going to Seattle where I knew Xavier Daniel, several of those players, and felt that there might be a better opportunity to play.
Yeah, I read somewhere along the way that you did a basketball clinic with Xavier McDaniel at some stage around this era as well. So you had a bit of a friendship with Xavier going back a few years there?
Yeah, Xavier and I both had signed with Spot Built Shoe Company.
Okay.
We had traveled around and done some clinics together and some youth development projects and a new ex a little bit from some of the All-Star games from high school, and also from going out to Wichita State for a visit. So I knew Xavier, knew he was a great player, and it was really a very nice welcome to be heading to Seattle to play.
I did see a photo from one of those clinics that you conducted with X-Man, and if I can find it, I'll definitely put it up on my Twitter feed to share with listeners of the show.
I would love to see that. I mean, where you were able to find some of those pictures is really a testament to your research abilities and your thoroughness around your guests, because some of those pictures I hadn't seen in a long time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I love to dig deep into the archives online and see what I can find. And yeah, I just love basketball history. So any chance I have to look into the history of somebody, I'll do what I can. In total, you played 43 games with the Sonics. The team was 27-26. You didn't have a lot of time to make an impact with Seattle, but what did you think of that short stay with the team?
I enjoyed being in an environment where there were younger players, and I was able to immediately get in and get some playing time and be a part of the 8-man rotation on that team. But unfortunately, there was just, you know, some personality clashes, I think, at that time with Coach Bickerstaff. Clearly, in retrospect, having matured and had some time to reflect back on that time and just kind of understanding how coaches are trying to put teams together. You know, there was some philosophical differences that just didn't work well. But, you know, with all due respect for Coach Bickerstaff, we were able to talk many years later and really, you know, kind of iron out some of the differences that we shared kind of during that time. And I have nothing but great respect for him as a coach and as a player and the incredible history he's been able to have in the NBA.
Yeah, incredible longevity. And again, I appreciate your openness and honesty. So thanks for that, Sam. Just prior to the NBA trade deadline in February of 88, Seattle traded you to the Chicago Bulls in, I think, pretty much a straight swap for Sadale Threet, who was a guest on my show back in episode 12. Had a great conversation with Sadale. I read a really interesting quote from Jerry Krause, who at the time said, and I quote here, "We're pleased to acquire Sam Vincent, who we've tried at various times to obtain in the last three seasons." Looking back on that deal to the Bulls, what were you feeling when you first arrived in Chicago?
Excitement. A whole lot of excitement. You know, I was getting a chance to join a team that had, you know, one of the best players in the league playing.
Yep.
And, you know, obviously a young superstar, and I wasn't exactly sure how I fitted into that or where it was going, but I knew Michael and, you know, we had established a pretty good friendship, and it was really exciting to be joining that team and thinking about having a chance to be in the backcourt with him.
It really opened up your game as well. Now, you rounded out that regular season starting in 27 of the 29 games, and your minutes per game almost quadrupled from what you had in previous seasons. And you averaged, I think it was 13 points and about 8.5 assists per game. Just before we chat about the 88 playoffs, can you just talk a little about your great play in Chicago and how you fit into that team as the regular season came to a close?
Well, I think one of the conversations I had with Michael when I first got there was around him saying that, you know, Chicago was a blue-collar town. And if you came in and you played hard and you left it all on the court, that the team and the fans would really support you. I really tried to come in with that as my motto, that every night I was going to go out and play as hard as I could and just kind of leave it on the court. And playing with Michael and with Scotty and Horace and the guys that were on that team, it was a younger team than what I was used to in Boston, and we had great camaraderie. So it was just a very fun time. Well, we had a great group. We had a lot of talent, and we had a great coaching staff. We had Doug Collins as our head coach and Phil Jackson as an assistant. So it was really an enjoyable time.
Fairly recently, some classic video footage surfaced of a visit that you made to the Nike factory in Portland. It was back in late March of 1988, and you're in a limousine with Michael Jordan and Charles Oakley. First of all, have you seen the clip? And if not, can you recall making a visit to that Nike store?
Well, two for two. I remember the day. It was, you know, one of those days you don't forget. And I have also seen the clip. I think someone either shared it with me or somehow I got posted on my Facebook. So I did get a chance to see it.
Was it a surreal experience, or was it just something like you're just there with a friend, of course, but how do you sort of put that into context all these years later when you look back at rare footage like this? It just happens to come out and really just turn everybody upside down.
Well, it was a very fond memory. It was in my early days of just arriving to Chicago. And of course, I knew Michael from McDonald's All-American games that we had played in earlier. And so we had a friendship, but had never really had the opportunity to spend as much time together as we did when I got to Chicago. So I just recall one road trip out to Portland. We were on the West Coast, and I remember him saying that he had an opportunity to get over to the Nike factory, and he was willing to take a couple guys along with him, and was wondering if Charles and I were interested in going. And you know, this is my first trip to the Nike factory, so of course I wanted to go and see what it was all about. But it was pretty incredible. I mean, you just kind of walk around with a cart and pick everything you want, and then they toll it up and put it in a bag for you. So it was, you know, one of those rare experiences.
Absolutely. It's just great footage. And in the show notes to this episode, I'll include a link to the footage of that. It's just to watch it some almost 30 years later. It's it's really eye-opening. And it might have seemed trivial at the time, but it's great to look back on all these years later. I must mention there's a particular game at Madison Square Garden in 1988. And you threw one of the great all-time alley-oops to Michael Jordan in a game against New York. And in that same game, you actually had an equal career high of 17 assists. Do you mind just talking us through that particular play and your performance in that game, Sam?
You know, everybody loves to play at the Garden. I remember at the beginning of that game, you know, spending a little time in the warm-ups with Michael and him saying he felt really good. And I remember shooting the ball really well in the warm-ups. And there's always electricity in the air when you're playing in New York. So at the beginning of the game, we were very excited. We were motivated and really charged to have a good game. And that play was not something that we thought about, but Michael and I always had pretty good eye communication. So I remember getting the ball and, you know, coming up the left wing and just kind of catching Michael out of my right eye and automatically knowing, just get it in the air. And once you do that, he's going to find it, he's going to track it, and he knows what to do with it. So it became one of those plays that we talked about a lot. You know, something that just as a point guard and a player, it's always been fun to have been connected with him on that play.
The crowd went absolutely insane, and that was the Knicks crowd reacting to your play. So it was quite incredible. Now, I alluded to this a bit earlier. In the 88 playoffs, you met the Detroit Pistons in the Eastern Conference semifinals. That current rivalry dated back to Jordan's rookie season. The first two games were at Detroit. And then after dropping the first game, you needed to come through with a big second game. So I'll let you talk about game two, but I'll just set the scene by saying that you starred, having a then career high 31 points and 27 of which were in the first half, and also had 5 assists and guided the Bulls to a victory. How did it feel to be back home playing such an outstanding game in a critical playoff performance?
Well, obviously it was a fantastic feeling. I think coming into that game, we knew the pressure that we were under to try to get a win. And at that point in time, we were still, you know, the underdogs to the Detroit Pistons. They were still the bad boys, and they were going to rough us up, and they were going to play tough and physical. And so, you know, we had read all the newspaper articles, and we felt confident as a team, but we knew we had to come in and do something a little different. And I remember at the beginning of that game, Coach Collins saying, you know, hey, Sam, these guys are really going to be keying on Michael. They're going to really be sitting in his lap and hitting him and trying to make it difficult. So if you can get some things going early, it might open up the lane for him later. And so that's all it took, was for him to make that comment. And I said, sure, no problem, Coach. That kind of gives me a license to go out and be a little bit more aggressive on the offensive end. And so the shot was falling. I was able to knock down a few jumpers earlier and got some real early confidence and had a lot of support from home there. And again, it was one of my better first half performances. And I was all ready in the second half to come out and do the same, but somewhere in the locker room around halftime, Michael said, hey, listen, you had a great first half, but make sure you pass in the second half. So once I got that word from him, I knew it was his turn to have a big second half, and I think he came out and maybe had 40 in the second half.
You're pretty much spot on there. He ended up with 36 for the game, but he was scoreless in the first quarter, and that's when you did all the damage. You had 15 points and 4 assists, according to a couple of newspaper articles I read, and were 11 of 13 from the field. So outstanding first half, and the Bulls were up by 15, I think, at halftime. So a tremendous effort from yourself. I'd love to mention a game that was in December of 88 at Chicago Stadium. You had probably one of the best games of the season. You had 23 points and 11 assists against your former team, the Celtics, in a 5-point win. Was it particularly satisfying to have such a great game against a former team? Were you using that as any sort of motivation, or that's just how it turned out to be on the day?
No, I think there was specific motivation to play well against the Celtics. You know, I think at every opportunity on some other team that I played against them, there was a little bit of a burning desire to, you know, just to say, hey, you know, maybe if I had got a little bit more time to finish developing as a player, but I was never envious of the Celtics. I was always happy that they gave me that chance to go out and get more time and to play more. So a little bit of a, you know, win-win kind of relationship I felt, you know, in terms of being there and being a part of a first year NBA championship team, but also having the chance to leave and, you know, join another team where the players were younger and I had a chance to have a little bit bigger role.
Even a modest fan of NBA history is familiar with the shot, Michael Jordan's series clinching jumper at Cleveland from the 1989 playoffs. Of course, you're there as a member of the team watching this happen. What was going through your mind in the closing moments, just that final timeout, and as the play unfolded to that incredible finish where it culminated with you guys all huddling on the court in celebration?
I remember the timeout, and I remember Coach Collins drawing up a play for Michael to either receive the ball or to initiate it kind of one-on-one at the top of the key. From there, everybody was just going to, you know, kind of clear out to the baseline. It was going to be an ISO play. I immediately felt good about the play call, about, you know, Michael's chances to score and to win the game. And as we got into the play and Michael got the ball, you know, Craig Elo, give him a lot of credit, was playing very tough defense, but Michael's hanging ability in the air just, you know, outlasted him, and he got a real good look at the basket. And whenever Michael gets a good look at a basket, then, you know, there's a good chance it's going to go in. So just one of, you know, a million incredible plays that he's had over his career.
In the 1989 season, you averaged just under 10 points, 3 rebounds, and 5 assists per game in only about 24 minutes of contest. This was also the season where Jordan had that amazing run of triple-doubles. He had 7 straight, and I think it was 10 in 11 games. Do you have many memories of that particular season and then meeting back with the Pistons again, this time in the Eastern Conference Finals?
I remember our team really evolving at that point. Michael was really, he was really becoming, you know, the bigger, broader superstar. Things, I think, around Scottie Pippen and Horace were starting to take some shape at that time. And I think, prior to that, a lot of the penetration and mid-range game that I had been playing successfully, the year before, started to change, and having more space on the floor and really going to the guys like John Paxson and Craig Hodges that really could give Michael the room to get to the basket and then, you know, be those deep 3-point range threats started to kind of change some of my playing time. But I remember it really being a time that the team continued to improve and some solid pieces were being put in place. And there was a lot of growth on the team, which was obviously leading up to, you know, some of those incredible Bulls championships that they later won.
In mid-June of 89, the Orlando Magic would select you in the NBA expansion draft. What do you recall of becoming an original member of that Magic franchise and making the move to Florida?
I remember being excited about leaving the cold weather.
Yeah, sure.
I thought at that time that was exciting. When I reflect back now, I realize I would have traded the warm weather for a couple more championship rings.
Understandable.
But, you know, Orlando Magic was coming in as a new team, and it was an opportunity to, again, play inside of a system where I would get more playing time. So, of course, that was exciting. I was also having a chance to sign, you know, what turned out to be a little bit bigger contract. So I was pretty motivated and looking forward to the opportunity to get to Orlando. Even though, again, I look back and I think, man, I missed the opportunity to play on some great Bulls teams that later went on and won a string of championships.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know, of course, but you weren't far removed from that magical run they started to encounter. So you just missed it by a season or two there, which is really unfortunate in retrospect. You spent three seasons with Orlando. I'd love to briefly ask you about a particular game that took place in February of 1990. It was Valentine's Day, and your former team, the Bulls, were visiting the arena. Michael Jordan's famous number 23 jersey went missing, inverted commas, missing, pre-game, and he was forced to wear jersey number 12, and your Magic won a thrilling game in overtime, probably one of the best wins of this first season for the team. Just a quick side note to this game, NBA Hoops would release two versions of your 1990-91 player card. The first one was soon deleted as the photo showed Jordan in the number 12 jersey. First of all, what do you remember about that great win over the Bulls? I think it was a 6-point win in overtime. And have you actually been told the real story behind why that first player card of yours was quickly replaced? That's a long-winded question, but...
Yeah, well, I'll make it a little bit shorter with my response. I do remember that game. It was a game that I was very excited and eager to play, and I remember getting off to an incredible first half. And the first half was so good that at the beginning of the second half, John Paxson was no longer guarding me, and Michael was. So I knew at that point that Phil had said, hey, somebody's got to get over there and guard Sam. So I remember that very well. But I also remember jersey number 12. As a result of his jersey being stolen right before the game. Apparently one of the eager fans was able to get into the locker room and get away with his jersey. Shortly after that, when they started creating the cards, I think it was somebody from the Jordan camp that called in and said, hey, wait a minute. You know what? This Sam Vincent card with Michael in is just not going to work. So. Even though I enjoyed the card and had a lot of people anxious to get it, there was a call made and the card was terminated.
That's an interesting backstory there. And, yeah, thanks for elaborating there. I was collecting the cards at the time over here in Australia and, managed to snag the first one and the replacement card. So they hold pride of place in that, set from that season. Now your last season as a player was 1992 and then the Magic traded you to the Milwaukee Bucks, which I actually wasn't aware of. In August of that year, but I believe you had an Achilles-related injury, which pretty much put an end to your playing career.
I will say that the end of the playing career did take place via an injury in Milwaukee. I went up for a jump shot in the corner against Gary Payton in a preseason game in Spokane. Came down and tried to turn and run up the court and snap my Achilles. And that was during a time where the technology around that specific injury was not as sharp as it is today in terms of, you know, recovery and rehab and just kind of getting back on the court. So, I had the surgery and developed some real bad scar tissue as a result of the injury and just was never able to get the same spring in my left leg. So I lost a lot of the speed and I lost a lot of agility and my jumping and decided to go overseas. As a result of that, communicating with my agent, I was able to land a playing opportunity in Thessaloniki, a team called Aris over in Greece. And really from that experience, just realized that trying to get back to the NBA with the diminished in speed and jumping that I had was going to be really a real tough challenge. So that short-lived international career was where I ended up finishing my basketball.
Okay, so I wasn't actually aware of the stint in Greece. How long were you playing over there for, or how many games did it take before you started to realize, wow, this probably is not going to happen?
I ended up playing the whole season.
Okay.
Got through it, and I had pretty good stats. I averaged about 17 points a game, and I was on that team with Sean Higgins from the University of Michigan, and we actually had a good team and did well.
Okay.
But I just never felt like the strength and the stamina and the endurance had got back into the leg and tried to push it a couple of times, but just never got back to a comfortable playing point.
I didn't actually know about that, so that's good to hear that you tried to extend the career overseas and possibly look to come back to the NBA, but it just didn't quite happen that way. This whole other area of your career after your post-playing days is absolutely fascinating, and we could probably have a massive conversation just about this alone. So we might jump back and forward a little bit in the timeline, but I've tried to put it in chronological order. I was certainly aware that you'd coached overseas after finishing your playing days, but I wasn't aware to the extent of how much that was until I started to fully research your career. It's very vast, and you've travelled all over the world. What first led to the opportunity to head to South Africa and coach the Cape Town Kings, I believe, in around 1996, SM?
Well, I remember a very short stint at Disney during the period that they were starting the new sports complex. I was working there with a gentleman named Reggie Williams, who was the vice president of sports. Had jumped on that staff with the responsibility of recruiting sports events to come down and participate at the new field. And I was there maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. You know, I enjoyed the whole Disney experience and being a part of that cast, but there was something that I just, you know, continued to miss about basketball, being on the court, working with players, just staying connected to the game. So I ended up traveling down to South Africa to do some research on where basketball was and how the sport was doing, and to kind of find out if I had, you know, land an opportunity to be involved. And I met with the owner of the Premier Basketball League, a guy by the name of Al Feinstein. And Al at that time said that there was 8 teams in the league, but they were interested in expanding. And if I wanted to get involved, not only could I be there as a coach, but I could be there as an owner.
Oh, okay.
So I ended up purchasing a franchise in that league. And that's what really started my coaching career. I coached the team. I was general manager, kind of did A to Z basketball operations.
Wow.
And stayed there for about 3 years, specifically just kind of, you know, getting through the nuts and bolts of running a team.
That's incredible. So how did you go with the transition of being a former player to then wearing all these multiple hats at the same time?
Well, I didn't find it too much of a struggle. I think the time that I spent in the corporate environment at Disney was a different kind of world. It was a different kind of responsibility, and I missed the game. So I think after doing that for about 6 months, it really opened my eyes up to how much I missed being around the sport and how much I still thought I had to offer. So even though when I went down to South Africa and got involved, I was doing a lot of things. It didn't feel like work to me. I mean, it was pure joy to be back around basketball and back on the court and, you know, participating in a game.
You were there for about 3 seasons or so with the Cape Town Kings, and then I believe even at the end of that time, you also became head coach of the men's and women's South African national teams. Just some great progression there from one to the next, and was it long before taking over those roles that you then returned back to Greece and also over to the Netherlands as well to do some more coaching?
Yeah, that's correct. So after, you know, working with the Kings for a while, like you mentioned, I started working with the national teams, and I was in Alexandria, Egypt for a African tournament that, we as South Africa was playing in against Nigeria. And not only Nigeria, but all the other African countries, Egypt and Mozambique and Congo, Cameroon, they were all there.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember having a conversation with somebody in the Nigerian delegation who had mentioned that they were, you know, happy to see how much success I was having with South Africa, which was really not that very talented of a team. And they were interested in having some conversation with me at some point if I was ever interested in coaching a team with a little bit more talent. And so I said, sure, I would, you know, always welcome coaching a team with a little bit more talent if the opportunity was right. And about a year later, I stepped out of South Africa and started coaching the Nigerian team. And then from there, you know, of course, had a chance to coach their men and women as well.
great experiences, and a majority of those things I wasn't even aware of until started doing a bit of a deep dive into what you've achieved. You also were involved in the 2004 Olympics, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, that's correct. We won the 2003 African Women's Championships in Maputo, Mozambique. And at that time, the Mozambique women team had several WNBA players. It was a very hot, heat contested game and brand new facility there in Mozambique. Probably had about 10,000 fans inside watching, which completely surprised me.
Yeah.
But I had a young player named Mfong Udoka, who had played at DePaul and also played in the WNBA, and Magdebit Amakri. And after some very tough games and then a finals against Mozambique, we were able to secure the Africa Championship, which got us a qualification into the Olympics 2004.
What an incredible run there. And what did you make of that Olympic experience?
The Olympic experience was pretty incredible. Staying in the Olympic Village, having a chance to, with our credentials, go and watch all of the other sports and get to know a lot of the other athletes.
Hmm.
It was truly an amazing experience, something that at the time, of course, I valued and appreciated, but I appreciate it so much more now afterwards, because it was a very big Olympic game that it had moved back to Greece for the first time since the beginning. It was a great games. It was a great experience, and, you know, something that, I kind of think to myself, Adam, I would love to have that opportunity one more time. So I'm trying to figure out how to get to Tokyo in 2020.
Oh, fantastic. Well, definitely we'll keep a close eye on how that progresses. Now, also incredibly in and around these overseas experiences, you also managed to find time to lead NBA D League team to the championship in 2003. Now, correct me if I'm wrong with the pronunciation. It's Mobile Revelers.
That was Mobile.
Mobile. Oh, gee. I had a 50-50 chance. I got it wrong. What was that like? Because I wasn't even aware that you had the involvement with the D-League at that stage. So forgive my ignorance there, but I'd love to hear more about how that sort of came to be and how did that sort of contribute to these coaching philosophies that you'd have and probably still have to this day.
Well, I remember connecting with Kim Bahuni, who was senior vice president with the NBA somewhere in the world. I'm not even sure where, but I remember us having a conversation and her saying that the NBA was getting ready to start a minor league and they were going to be starting their first batch of teams out in the Southeast. And I should reach out to a guy named Rob Levine and go through the interview process and see if I could get one of the jobs, which of course I did, and ended up getting the Mobile job. And, at that time, we had Alex English, Nate Archibald, Rob Thornton. So we had several other NBA players that were connected to the D League at that time. And just really excited to be able to connect to something that I've been talked about for a long time, in terms of creating the minor league for the NBA and us being the, you know, some of the pioneers in terms of having the first opportunity to kick it off. So that was a great experience. Some great coaches, that first year in Mobile. We got to the semifinals where we lost to Alex English and the Charleston Logators. And then the next year we added Isaac Fontaine and one other kid, Derek Hood. And that just really kind of took us over the top. We had a great year and I was able to win a championship that second season at Mobile.
Wow. Just fantastic memories there to look back on. And, when you hear these sort of things mentioned back to you, are you surprised in any way about and the breadth and depth of what you've done coaching wise? Or is it sort of something that you just take in your stride and you continue to see what's next and what's coming up ahead?
Well, no, you know, actually I do. I often think, I don't know how I had the time to do all the things that I did. I don't know how I fit it in. Geographically, there's a lot of different countries I was in, a lot of different teams I was working with. And I think during that period, I was just kind of grinding it out. I was working, you know, kind of straight through the fall into the summer, just kind of year-round coaching. And, you know, I really appreciate it now because I feel like it has created some real depth. I sometimes try to figure out if that's going to lead me back into, you know, more coaching opportunities or, you know, writing a book to tell some of the stories about some of these incredible opportunities. But I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to, you know, work with all the players that I had a chance to work with and to coach all the teams because they were all really incredible experiences.
Absolutely. And for brevity, I'll going to have to skip a few things along the way here. Otherwise, we'll be here for another hour or so. But I really enjoy hearing you talk about this. So thanks again for making yourself available. Now, you were back in the USA for the 2007 NBA season, and you were an assistant coach for the Dallas Mavericks. Now, that year, the Mavs went 67-15, number one seed in the playoffs, before a shock first round exit to the number eight seed Golden State Warriors. Before we actually even just chat about that playoff series, what do you remember about that first season coaching in the NBA?
Man, it was a fantastic year. You know, having a chance to work with Avery Johnson, and Joe Prunty and Del Harris, all pretty reputable, solid coaches, was, fantastic for me. I think that team was a very talented team, you know, headed up by Dirk Nowitzki. And we had a fantastic year. I think I grew a lot as a coach. You know, Coach Avery developed a lot of his coaching schemes behind Greg Popovich because he spent a lot of time there and won a championship with Popovich. So I felt like I got a little insight into Avery, but also a little bit into Popovich in terms of defensively how they focus and offensively how they set things up and how they manage players.
Mm.
So that was a great experience. Really enjoyed it. Kind of wish sometimes I had stayed a little bit longer than the 1 year, but you know, how do you turn up a head coaching opportunity? So that kind of led to something else.
Absolutely, it did. And, we've discussed obviously your links back to Michael Jordan. They're going back to as far as 1981 at that McDonald's High School All-American game. Now, after you've worked that season as an assistant with the Mavs, MJ brought you in as head coach of the Charlotte Bobcats for the 2008 season. This is, just a fascinating period of time that, I'd welcome any observations you'd like to make about this. How did that opportunity come to be? Of course, you've got that storied history of knowing MJ for that long, but clearly he saw plenty in you that made him pull the trigger on bringing you in as the head coach.
That's true. I got a call from Michael. Michael said, hey, you know what? I'm going to be making a coaching change at the end of the year. I'm sure you remember Bernie Bickerstaff was the coach at that time. And
absolutely.
And he said, you know, I'm interested in talking to you, and then you go through the interview process with a few other people. Are you interested? Of course I'm interested. You know, I think every assistant coach's dream is to be the head coach in the league, and to have the opportunity to connect with Michael and be there in Charlotte was like a dream come true. So yeah, it was an incredible opportunity and something that, you know, will always, no matter how things went, will always be one of my best basketball memories.
For sure. In that one season with the Bobcats, you went 32-50. And after that, do you mind just perhaps chatting about the subsequent years that followed, some of the opportunities that you had along the way?
Well, after the Bobcat season, I ended up getting a call from Michael, and Michael, you know, said kind of based on a variety of different reasons, felt it was the best move to make to go a different direction, which was obviously a tough decision for me at that time. I thought we had a pretty good year that first year with 32 wins and with a very mediocre team.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understood that's the business and a lot of things go into that. So immediately following that year, I went out and coached in the D League just to kind of stay involved with the game. I coached a team out in Anaheim. Had a pretty good year there. Had a couple of NBA guys that I was able to develop. And then from there, got back involved with national team coaching. Coached the Jamaica national team, spent some more time coaching in Nigeria with the men and women team, and then headed off and most recently coached in the Middle East for 3 years. At that point, my interest was really just trying to stay in touch with the game and continuing to coach.
Thanks again for elaborating a bit further there about the end of your time there with the Bobcats. I didn't want to press too much, so anything you're willing to say is appreciated. Now, I read that in 2015, you led a team to the Bahrain League Championship. I probably will butcher the pronunciation, so do you mind just saying what the name of the team was?
It was the Al Manama Club.
Uh-huh. And how was that experience there? And I've seen as recently as only in the last few weeks some photos of you online where you're wearing a T-shirt that actually also says the name of that. Is it Al Manama?
Yeah, Al Manama. You know, it was a fantastic experience. Prior to taking the job, I had a lot of people say that, you know, it was a tough region to coach in, that the players were really undisciplined and that I wouldn't enjoy the specific team that I was going to. But, you know, I kind of saw all of that as a challenge and decided to go ahead and take the job. And I can honestly say that, you know, I really enjoyed being in Bahrain. The Middle East was fantastic. The players there, you know, like any team, you're going to have some things that you got to work on and some adjustments you got to make. But by the end, I feel like I had a good team. We were successful. I enjoyed those 3 years, just kind of rounding out and having a chance to coach in an area that was new to me.
Now, in the second half of last year, you returned to the helm of Nigeria's women's team and led them to the 2017 AfroBasket title. So you mentioned your links to Nigeria commenced in the early 2000s. So to return back and lead the team to that victory, how was that experience for you? And do you mind just elaborating a little bit more on that?
Well, it was a little surreal. I got a call from Mfong Udoka, who was one of my players on the team on that 2004 Olympic team. And I hadn't really been connected to the team over, you know, several years.
Mm-hmm.
And Mfong told me that they were having some issues with the coaching staff they had considered, and they needed someone who, you know, understood Nigeria, and had some sort of feel for coaching in Africa and what it would take. And speaking on behalf of the Federation, she was wondering if I'd be interested. And I told her, you know, yeah, under the right circumstances, I had a good time, previously coaching Nigeria, even though this was a whole different set of women.
Mm-hmm.
I was willing to take it on. So I took the job. We were a little bit behind in our preparation and training period, but once we got to Bamako, Mali, all of the members of the team really huddled up real tight and our chemistry was great. And we were really, you know, determined and focused to go out and play our best and see if we could win the tournament. And, you know, I can honestly say it was a great tournament. Our team was 8-0. We didn't lose any games. We qualified for the World Championships in Spain this September. It was fantastic being able to reconnect with the country, the Federation, and once again lead those ladies to an African championship.
Fantastic stuff. And what time frame do you see that the preparation for the championships later this year will start to really kick into high gear?
Right now, we're looking at sometime middle of May as the beginning of training, and that'll carry on through June. And we'll look at some of the potentially new players. And then in July, we'll round our team out. In August, we'll be involved in a series of competitive games in a few different countries. And then early September, we'll start with a small series of events in Nigeria. And then by mid-September, we'll be in Spain.
Yeah, well, so yeah, time will certainly be upon you before you even know it. So all the best with that.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Now, as recently as a few weeks ago, you were in New Delhi, India, promoting the game of basketball. Actually, before I even go further, have you ever been to Australia before in terms of coming out to do anything with the game?
No, I have not had a chance to reach Australia, but I have been working with a gentleman named Sandeep Singh, who has some pretty extensive relationships in Australia. We've been talking about forming some partnerships to come out and do some clinics or work with some coaches. So that is something that I'm pretty excited and eager to do and hoping will happen sometime soon.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I'd like to hear that. So if that ever does happen and I'm anywhere within a few hours of where you're going to be, I'd love to have a chance to meet you. In terms of New Delhi and you're all around the different countries promoting the game of basketball, two words that are often associated with yourself, and I'm sure it's no coincidence, global coach, that's most apt. What do you hope that Global Coach International can achieve?
Well, I formed the name Global Coach, you know, honestly, just because of the variety of countries that I've had a chance to be connected with and coach in. And in each of these areas, you know, the primary responsibility is always the professional team that I'm working with, but there's always a secondary responsibility to work with the youth teams and to try to develop some of the youth coaches and some of the younger players. And so just kind of in that capacity, I really started to move more in that space of considering myself global coach as it relates to having a chance to work with players, you know, all around the world and share, you know, some of the, you know, just some of the real key principles that I've learned from some of the incredible coaches that I've worked with and some of the incredible players to help players develop their game and to understand how hard you have to work to be good and, you know, some of the things that'll help you along the way. So now in this partnership with the AAU, we form what we're calling the AAU Global Coach Academy. And it's really just in partnership with the AAU, my opportunity to reach out to different federations, different coaches, different players, different clubs, and come in and try to share, you know, what I believe are some incredible experiences to help players, like I said, improve their game and become the best players they can be.
A great mission there, and wishing you continued success with that. It'd be remiss of me not to ask the following. Given that you're only 54, would you entertain an opportunity to re-enter the NBA or college coaching ranks? I know you'd mentioned that you'd like to get back to the Olympics as well, or perhaps, you know, write a book or whatever the opportunities might present themselves, but would an NBA position again get some serious consideration from yourself?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. I feel like, you know, the whole Bobcat situation was something that, you know, all coaches get fired. So it wasn't something that I couldn't believe happened. But it was a little bit of a tough time for me. So I really just kind of wanted to be away from, that level for a bit. And I can honestly say I feel like the time that I spent away and working in the international space and developing, you know, some teams around the world has been very positive for me. But now if there was an opportunity to get back to the NBA and work with a team and help develop, you know, some of the young players, that's something I would welcome doing.
Yeah, I truly hope that certainly is on the horizon for you if that does present itself. Just a couple quick questions to round things out. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show and chat with you for this period of time. Just before we get to those questions, is there anything else from your international coaching career that you'd like to add or elaborate further on?
Well, you know what? Nothing, Adam, actually from the international side, but there is something I would like to touch on. You know, there was some time after being released from the Bobcats, there was an article that was written in, I think, the Washington Post or the Washington Times that I really felt misquoted me as it related to some comments around Michael. And the journalist at that time, I'm not sure what his angle was. Maybe he had a little bit of a beef with Michael from his Washington days or something, but he really kind of moved me into a question that I thought was a little unfair. And the question really was kind of around whether or not I thought Michael wanted to be as good of a owner as he was a player. I still honestly believe that that's a little bit of a personal question for Michael, because, you know, for Michael to be the player that he was, which was to me the best player ever to play, that took a lot of energy. It took a lot of focus. It took a lot of drive, and it took a lot to accomplish that. And then whether or not his focus, his drive, his energy to be an owner is in the same capacity, that's only something Michael can answer. And so my response to the journalist was, you know, I don't know. That's a question you'd have to ask Michael, whether or not he feels like he wants to reach those same heights as an owner. But the story was misquoted, and it's something that has really kind of been out there and been a little bit of a negative. And, you know, I would never question Michael's energy, his drive, his focus to be the best. That's who he is. He wants to be the greatest in whatever he does. And surely I would never question that. That's what I know him to be. But I really felt the way the question was asked and the way it was framed up was a little bit inappropriate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad that you've had a chance to, elaborate on that. And hopefully that certainly can get any, misconceptions based on how it was printed, clarified for sure. Basketball Digest had a regular feature that's called The Game I'll Never Forget. Now, there's a fair chance we probably already covered it in one way, shape or form, but is there one game from your career, either a player or coach, that stands out above the rest?
Oh, man.
That's putting you on the spot, isn't it?
Man, there's so many.
There doesn't have to be one. You don't need to choose one, but I just was curious if there was one.
There's a lot, but if there is one game that I would talk about that I had to kind of single out, it would probably be the Eastern Conference against the Detroit Pistons in game two. We went into Detroit and we had gotten beat up in game one, and you know, we were really trying to make a dent in this series and see if we could kind of turn the tide and get past the Pistons that year. I remember, you know, Coach Collins having a very, very spirited pregame chalk talk. And in that first half of that game, just really played extremely well. And I remember that game so well because Michael came up to me and was like, "Hey man, you had a good first half, but let's make sure you're passing the ball a little bit more in the second half." I think I ended up with 31 points for that game. It was an incredible game, an incredible memory. We did win that game, although we lost the series. And out of all the games, that one just kind of stands out because I was at home in Detroit against Isaiah in the Eastern Conference, and it was just a big game.
Obviously, it's a good one that does come to mind quite quickly. Just a quick side tangent based on that response. You had Doug Collins as your head coach, and you had Phil Jackson behind the scenes as well as an assistant. It wasn't too long after you'd left the Bulls that Phil, of course, took over the head coaching job with the Bulls and then led them to that incredible run of success. How do you sort of compare and contrast a Doug Collins versus a Phil Jackson? I guess obviously Doug wears his heart on his sleeve, no doubt. But what did you make of the comparison between those two guys there, Sam?
Well, I thought both Doug and Phil were great coaches. I thought Doug was a great coach who had been a very brilliant player and really was bringing a lot of the player emotions and a lot of that just kind of raw, genuine connectivity to his coaching style. And I thought Phil was very much different. I thought Phil also was a good player, but was a lot more systematic in his thought process and a lot more strategic with his emotions and his delivery. I think just because of that, you know, he probably handled the team a little bit different. And I think the players related to him a little bit different.
Gotcha. Thank you for opening up about that. Now, the final question I'd like to ask, and this one does elicit some different responses depending on the significance, but did you have any particular significance to the jersey numbers that you wore during your career? At Eastern, I believe you wore number 44 and maybe 45 on the road. I'm not sure. Michigan State, you had number 11 and then you wore number 11 throughout your NBA days. Any particular significance to those numbers, Sam?
Well, Jay, my older brother, and Magic were really my early inspiration to playing basketball in Lansing, Michigan, where, you know, I grew up and my brother Jay was a same year as Magic and both 6'8", 6'9" players and having some incredibly heated, contested battles at the high school level. They kind of created this, you know, motivation for me to play. So when I started playing 4 years later at Eastern High School, I wore my brother Jay's number 44. And that was really kind of the reason why I chose that number, was because it was his number at Eastern as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got through my collegiate days, I was really a little bit more of an Isaiah Thomas fan with number 11 and the way he played with the Detroit Pistons. That really became where I landed on number 11 and kind of stayed with it.
Right. Okay. Well, that's intriguing, particularly given that you'd be a member of the Bulls around the time where the Bad Boys sort of reputation was almost at its heights. How was your interaction with Isaiah, either on or off the court, in terms of just Detroit in general?
You know, the relationship was always good. You know, Isaiah was very close to Magic, and by that time, Magic had left Michigan State, went to the Lakers, you know, won the NBA championship in his rookie season and had formed these real close bonds with a lot of the NBA guys like Isaiah, Mark McGuire, Daryl Dawkins. And these guys would come to Lansing and we would play during the summertime. So I had developed a real close relationship with Isaiah. I knew him. We were pretty good friends, and that made picking number 11 and wearing it because of Isaiah, really, you know, really easy to do.
Thanks for sharing that. Always fascinates me to see what a player might come back with for the reason. Sometimes it's just, oh, that's the only number that was available and I kept it for my career. But other times there's some really good stories behind the scenes. Now, Sam, it's been fantastic to have you on the show today. Thanks again for chatting with me for this period of time. And I wish you all the best in no matter what direction you go with your coaching career going forwards. But just thanks again for having a chance to chat with me.
Well, Adam, it's been a pleasure. I enjoy reading your post and following your site. So again, a pleasure being on. I wish you the best and look forward to speaking to you again sometime down the road.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallairness.com/voice. Click start recording. Leave a message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Worldwide, the show currently has 73 reviews, 70 on iTunes and 3 on Stitcher. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are certainly one of the best ways that you can support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallairness.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Apple Podcasts, visit inallairness.com/iTunes. Android, visit inallairness.com/Android. Add it to your Stitcher playlist, inallairness.com/Stitcher. You can now subscribe to the show on Spotify, Plus, Pocket Casts, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, other podcatchers, and of course, via the Podcasts app on your iOS device of choice. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at inallairness. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/inallairness. Join me next time for another edition of the show.